Well, good afternoon. It is 12:02 here on WASR, a rainy Friday, and once again, I'm Eric Scott. Hello there. Time to have our weekly conversation with the state senator and Wolfboro resident Jeb Bradley. Senator, thank you again for being with us today.
Always a pleasure. How are you?
I am well, sir. You don't really, do you hike in the rain? Out of curiosity?
No. I mean, you know, sometimes you get caught in a shower.
Right.
But if I know it's going to be wet like this, no. It's miserable, and I wouldn't mind a hike like this. Like in Florida, for instance, where it might feel good to, you know, be wet. But on a day like today, when you go on the White Mountains, it's probably about 50 on the summit of Mount Washington, or maybe even lower. And so you're actually in hypothermic conditions. You know, if you keep moving, you'll generally be okay, but it's just not a good idea. Even with all the best gear and equipment, you still are going to get wet. Now, have I done it? Yes. But generally, it's, you know, if you're doing a 2-3-4 day camping hike, and you know you can't predict the weather the entire time, but right. On a day like today, I would not do a day hike starting out in weather like this, where I knew it was going to be this wet.
No, I can't blame you. On the other hand, we do need the rain desperately. So,
it's a good idea. It's good that we're getting all this rain, but I think hopefully we get good weather coming for the rest of the summer, and you know people can enjoy the beautiful summer.
Yeah, I heard that they canceled the Jericho ATV Festival again up in Berlin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like, oh, come on, guys, really? I mean, I understand why they canceled it last year, but. I know, because some friends of mine were really hoping to go up there and found out it got canceled. Anyway, onward and upward. Are you amazed, Senator, at the things you learn when you read a bill?
I think it's, you know, always a good thing to read the legislation and try to understand it that you're voting on. You know, it's not always possible when you have thousands of bills in any, well, maybe not thousands, but 1,000 probably in this legislative session. So you do rely on the committee structure, you know, where every committee has to have a public hearing on a bill. I tend to read, you know, the hearing reports on bills as well as the bill, you know, especially when there's legislation that hasn't gone through a committee that I'm on, but you know, it's pretty important to know what's in it.
How many bills do you read in an average week?
I'd say 10 to 15, and we would deal with a lot of bills are pretty simple and not controversial, so that's where the committee structure comes in. If something's not controversial and hasn't generated, you know, any significant opposition in a hearing or a hearing report, those would be bills I might not read. But anything that, you know, is more complicated, controversial, technical in nature, you know, that's what has to be read. I mean, I spent quite a bit of time reading, you know, it's called the trailer bill of the budget, or HB2. Some sections I actually wrote. And so I knew them really well, but I think it ended up about a 250-page bill, and I'd say I read it 2 or 3 times, you know, in pieces. Sometimes it was, okay, I want to read up on education savings accounts and just make sure I'm, you know, but I like that piece, that was a bill of mine, and I still probably read it 20 times, so.
Right. Interesting.
When you go into a debate, you want to be, you know, have it fresh in your memory of what it does, what it doesn't do. And, you know, for me, you absorb more the second, third, fourth time you read something.
Okay. Which brings me to the next question is, why, and I don't mean this the way it sounds, why do you continue to work the equivalent of a full-time job when you could be hiking or gardening or playing with grandchildren or things like that?
Well, now you got me stumped on a hard question, Eric. Look, I feel incredibly fortunate that I love to do this job. I mean, there are, you know, it's not the easiest job in the world, and, you know, not everybody agrees with everything you do and all of that, but I've always enjoyed public service. I think it's important. I enjoy the challenge of the job. I enjoy trying to bring people together to come to common sense solutions to problems that affect, you know, people and our state. I like working, you know, the challenges of getting to yes. I think I've said it many times on this show and others in the state house, in the nation's capital, wherever. No is always easy, because there are so many steps in the process and so many opportunities for things to fall apart. And trying to get a critical mass to get it, you know, into the end zone, so to speak, to score the touchdown. You know, I still, after all these years, find it challenging and rewarding, and I enjoy it. And, you know, I'm very blessed that I have good health, and, you know, I'm really grateful for the support that people have given me to allow me to do something that, you know, is both hard work but very intellectually rewarding, and just a great job.
Okay. You've always said that yes is harder to get to than no. Why do you think that is? Is it human nature? Is it just the, is it inertia? What do you think it is?
I think at least in Concord, but also Washington too, excuse me, there are a lot of steps that legislation has to go through to get from an idea to being signed into law. And so if there are any financial implications to a bill, it generally has two stops in both the Senate and the House. It goes to the policy committee, and then it has to go to the finance committee. So a lot of pieces, for instance, in the budget went through policy committees first before they went into the budget. So that means a vote in the committee. It means a vote on the floor. Then it goes to the second committee. Then it goes back to the floor, and the process is repeated on the House. So you've got, you know, two separate votes in the Senate, two separate votes in the House. Then there may have to be a committee of conference where it can fall apart or it can come together. Then the Senate, then the House has to vote all over again on the final package. And then the governor, you know, he or she has to sign the bill. So at any one of those stages, things can get upended and it, you know, falls apart. And it does. A lot of things, you know, that happens. And to get especially complicated and maybe controversial legislation through, it just means you've got to really work at it to have the critical mass all along to, you know, get it passed in the law. And at any one of those stages, if it's defeated, yes, it can come back, but once it's been defeated once, it's much harder to bring something back a second time. So, you know, it's just, that's the way it is, and it's the way it should be. I don't think that, you know, every good idea is not necessarily translatable into good legislation. And so, you know, our system in the United States and in New Hampshire, too, is based on checks and balances. And, you know, the Senate is a check on the House. The House is a check on the Senate. The governor is a check on the legislature. The court is a check on the legislative branch and the executive branch. So our process is designed to be inclusive, difficult, and it's like climbing a mountain. You know, there are a lot of different steps to get at the top, and when you're at the top, you still have to get to the bottom. And, you know, so there is an entire process. And oftentimes the first step is the hardest, but oftentimes every step along the way is hard too.
Right. Were there any bills that you really wanted to see passed and didn't in the last session?
Yeah, there is, and it hasn't died. It was held over for study in the House. So maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we passed, you know, legislation known as bail reform. And it was meant to, so its proponents stated, it was meant to make sure that everybody had equal access to bail. And so if you were a person of modest means, charged with a crime that was somewhat minor in nature, say, you could get bail in hopefully the same way as somebody of, you know, more means had, who could afford, you know, cash bail. Okay, so well-intended. The way it worked out wasn't as hopeful. I think there may have been some misinterpretation by judges and bail commissioners, but be that as it may, there were violent criminals who were being let out after they, I shouldn't say criminals, but they were alleged to have committed violent offenses, they were arrested for it, and got bail right away, and reoffended. And so it was the reoffending part that really had me concerned that, and it's not just a New Hampshire problem, this has swept the country, that people, you know, were being arrested allegedly for committing a violent crime. And then, you know, we had a number of cases in New Hampshire that people were reoffending right away in a violent manner. And so I had a bill this year that would have put the brakes on that process. And instead of somebody automatically receiving, you know, or getting PR bail, in other words, no cash, they get bail on personal recognizance, and they're back out on the street right away, that if they were charged with, you know, more crimes that were violent in nature, assault, stalking, domestic violence, pornography crimes, obviously some of the rape, manslaughter, murder type crimes. There were, I think, 9 or 10 specific crimes, violent in nature, that instead of automatically being able to get bail, they would have to go before a judge within 72 hours and have a hearing. And passed the Senate. It had bipartisan support in the Senate. It did have some opposition, but I think the vote was 17-7. And as I recall, 13 Republicans out of 14 voted for it, and 4 Democrats voted for it. Good bill. Got to the House. The ACLU and others raised, you know, objections to it, even though it was pretty narrow in scope. The committee tried to amend it, but they didn't have the votes. And so instead of, they didn't kill it, so they held it over for study, and I think next year it comes back, and I have a plan to pass it.
Now, when you say held over for study, does that mean that somebody actually sits down and studies the impact of this?
So what it means is that this is a procedure in the House where a committee, and in this case it was the Criminal Justice Committee, decided as a committee that they were not going to vote to send it to the floor, either for an up or down vote, but they were going to retain it. So they voted to retain it. That means it stays in committee, and it has to come out with a recommendation of either pass it with an amendment, potentially kill it, or the third option in the second year is what's called interim study, which is basically a polite death. So the committee will have a chance to, you know, further look at it, and hopefully they will realize that reforms need to be made, that we need to protect people from, you know, the rash of violent crime. And thankfully, New Hampshire is a lot better than other states, but we're better than other states because we are on the side of law and order. And this has been one of those instances where, you know, several years ago, a good idea of making sure that, you know, indigent people or people that don't have, you know, much cash do have access to bail. But the way it's been implemented, and I think part of that problem with the way it was written, has let people out on the street that have reoffended. And there have been some pretty bad examples. And so I was pretty upset. Thought about, you know, including it in the budget, where we did put a number of other policy pieces of legislation in. But at the end, I decided that it would be better to try to do it as a standalone bill next year. And I think there is going to be legislation to try to enact some of the same provisions for youth and how they get detained and held at the youth detention center. And I think it would make a very good combination if we're going to, you know, make changes to, you know, some of the guidelines of sentencing and youth detention for people that are under 18, to combine that with, you know, reform of bail reform. And so that's my plan for next year.
You know, it's funny you say that when you talk about bail. Anecdotally, a friend of mine's ex-husband was arrested last year on child molestation charges, got PR bail, and was out for about a year and a half before the trial came, which just happened, by the way, last month, and he was convicted, so there's that. But, I mean, is that an offense that you should be getting bail for? Is that part of what this bill is?
And that would be something that maybe you would get bail, but it wouldn't be automatic. It would have to go before a judge for a hearing.
Right.
And so, you know, I argue that this is actually a pretty modest reform, that it just not be automatic, that you'd have to have a hearing on these, you know, I mean, child molestation. It was one of the categories that, you know, I included in the bill. You should have to go before a judge and then at least have a judge make a determination. Is this person likely to reoffend and recommit? And if the answer is, you know, they're not likely to reoffend and recommit, then okay, bail. But if it's somebody that's, you know, violent behavior, especially in domestic violence kind of situation, which would cover child molestation, those are some of the most common things that can escalate out of control pretty quickly, and you have, you know, people that are violently attacked or even worse. And so I think we want to try to prevent that.
No, I agree. 1221 here on WASR. My guest, Jeb Bradley, of course, Wolfboro resident and New Hampshire State Senator. What can we do to attract younger people to the House and the Senate? I know there are some, including locally Brody Deshaies, who's, what, 23, I think? Which is fantastic.
Yeah, Brody's doing a great job. I mean, he's doing a really good job. And, you know, it's tough to be in the New Hampshire legislature and hold a full-time job. And that's why, you know, there are a lot of retirees in the legislature. You know, one of the as I always say, one of the beauties of the legislature is we're only paid $100. So, you know, people can stay there for a long time, obviously, but it's a volunteer job. And because it's a volunteer job, I think people go for the right reasons. And I think that produces a much better product, and people are more in touch with, you know, New Hampshire residents as a result. But at the same time, you got to be able to live. And so some people have flexible employers. Some people are self-employed. You know, other people work nights. You know, other people are retired. So that is, you know, because we're not paid in the legislature, it does make it, you know, if you're in the earning years of your life when you need to work, it makes it, you know, harder.
Right. But then those people really don't have as much representation in Concord as they could have.
And I, you know, I hear what you're saying. It's like anything else. There's nothing that's ever been devised, you know, that's perfect.
True.
So I think, you know, the pluses definitely outweigh the minuses. But that is a minus, that people need to make a living. And so, you know, it does limit the pool of people that can serve.
Yeah, it does. Is politics as much of a contact sport as it's portrayed on TV?
Yeah, and it's becoming more so in New Hampshire all the time. It's still not as bad by any stretch of the imagination as Washington is, but, you know, just the recent budget debate that we had, it is a contact sport, no question, with no, you know, no helmets and no pads.
Really? It's almost like it is a zero-sum game where there has to be winners and losers?
I think that that is a way that people look at it. I don't necessarily see it that way, because much of the legislation that we actually, you know, pass and goes to the governor is nonpartisan. And I'd say that we agree on 70%, maybe 75% of all the bills that come through, but where we disagree, we have some pretty fundamental disagreements. And when there are disagreements, those are what get, you know, what gets blown up. And I think, you know, we're seeing both in Washington definitely, but also, you know, in Concord a lot more all the time, that, you know, people are being dominated in their way of, you know, dealing with issues on whatever the narrative is of that political party. And so that just, it makes the debates on the issues that are, you know, contentious more partisan, more personal, more driven by, you know, people that are not coming from the middle, coming from a place of common sense, which is where I think most New Hampshire voters are. And I'm not sure that's, you know, in the long run, good for the process, but it is what it is.
Maybe it's me, and I've seen too many of these talking head shows, but have a lot of politicians lost the plot? I mean, the whole plot was, at least, you know, on paper, to represent the citizens, but it's now become a nonstop race to get reelected and to raise money and to make sure that you don't say anything stupid. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean, and I think that I think there is too much being driven by the narrative, by you know, the agenda of both parties. So sometimes it's harder to reach compromise. I think that you know, every 2 years there's an election in this country, and obviously it's the same in New Hampshire, which is a good thing overall, I think. But it also leads to, you know, people just fighting for the gavel every 2 years as opposed to trying to work problems out. And I think that is problematic. And, you know, the more that happens, I think the more the process suffers.
How much does ego fit into politics?
A lot. Especially as we've, it's not just that oftentimes you want to be on the winning side of an issue, but you want the other side to become the losing side of an issue too. And so I think that rather than, you know, try to focus on doing the right thing for the right reason, you know, winning becomes its own answer at all costs. And so, you know, I've always felt that we win in New Hampshire in, you know, public affairs when the state is doing well, when there's good job opportunities, when paychecks are increasing, when we rank really well on, you know, the most livable state in the nation surveys, when, you know, we do well on surveys of protecting children or, you know, the education of our workforce or our unemployment rate or our poverty rate. And on all these national indicators where New Hampshire gets ranked against the other 49 states, we almost always outperform and are near the top on all of these rankings that I just mentioned and others too. And I think that if, you know, we focus more on, you know, trying to adopt policies that, you know, get us to a point where the state is performing well, then we all win. And there's credit for everyone. So it wouldn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. There's credit for everyone if you find common ground. But, you know, it's there's too much. It's going to be my way, and it's going to be this way, and your way is, you know, because it's your way, is not good enough. And, you know, people dig in, and I think the process is, you know, it harms the overall, you know, ability of the state to do well. And that should be our goal.
Okay. Back in the 60s and 70s, we always heard about something called the generation gap, which I admit exists, especially now as a parent of two adult children. But has it increased or decreased in terms of politics? Do younger politicians have trouble relating or talking to older ones and vice versa?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, when I first started in the New Hampshire legislature, I think I was 37.
So you're pretty young.
And now I'm 68. So I was one of the younger members, you know, back 30 years ago. And, you know, by now I'm, you know, I'm the white-haired geezer. So, and I think that, I don't know, in the Senate, there are fewer of us, so I don't think we tend to put labels on people as much because there are only 24 of us. In the House, that's probably more of a, you know, more of a thing, but in the Senate, again, because there are only 24 of us, I think it's hard to just label people.
Are there any younger people on the Senate or in the Senate?
Yeah, no, there are. There's several. I think Rebeccan's perfect focus in her 30s. She's a first-term senator from Portsmouth, and she is pregnant now. And so, you know, she's obviously pretty young. Erin Hennessy is in her mid-40s. She represents District 1, the North Country, I think. Kevin Avard he's in his 40s, I'm pretty sure. I'm trying to go around the room, and, you know, there's several of us in our 60s. There are even a couple that are in their 80s. There's some in their 70s, some in their 50s. So we try to think. Senator Whitley, she's in her, I'd say she's early 40s, maybe. Senator Gannon is probably in his 50s.
So the Senate is
I think
younger
we have
than
some diversity
than Utah.
In terms of age.
Okay. As far as, and it's funny, you mentioned diversity. Are there any minority members of the House and Senate that you know of?
Definitely in the House. There, Senator Melanie Levesque was, a woman of color. She represented Nashua, District 12 last year. She lost to Senator Avard this time around. And, but I think, trying to remember exactly, there are more men than women in the Senate, but, there are a lot of women in the Senate. I don't remember off the top of my head the exact count, but five Republicans, so 5 out of the 14 Republicans.
Well, that's not bad. You've seen a lot of people come and go through the House and the Senate. What's the biggest mistake a new lawmaker makes?
There are any number of mistakes that anybody can make, new, old. I think the biggest mistake anybody can make is thinking they know everything and not listening to other people. Those are probably the two biggest mistakes. And you can, it doesn't really matter if you're new or you've been there forever. If you think you have all the right ideas, you're going to be disabused of that notion pretty quickly. And that's where compromise comes in, and it's where, somebody else may be able to take your good idea and make it better, or turn your idea that has some merit into it but has some problems with it into something better. And you just have to be willing to, to listen to other people's point of view and then try to, shape things that work for the vast majority of people in the state of New Hampshire. I think when we do that, we end up with good legislation. When we don't do that, that's when we end up with, bad legislation.
Is it hard when what you want personally conflicts with what you should be doing professionally? In other words, let's say there's a bill came up and you thought it was a hell of an idea, but you knew it wouldn't be a good idea for your constituents. Is that kind of thing? Or vice versa, if you think it's a lousy idea, but you're getting a lot of positive feedback on the bill, would you consider voting for it?
I mean, I have in the past voted for things that I personally don't think are, all that smart. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. If I think, the vast majority of the people I represent would support something like that, even though I might not like it. And I'm trying to think of an example, but maybe one will come to mind. It happens, but I'd say in my case it's pretty rare. But here's one example, and we've talked about this before. I think there are a lot of people in New Hampshire that would support, increasing the statewide property tax. That's the tax that creates donor towns. Well, 8 of the towns I represent would be donor towns, and depending on the level of the tax rate set, it could be 10 or 11, maybe even 12 of the communities I represent would be donor towns. Okay, so while folks in Nashua and Manchester and other communities would say, oh, this is great, the statewide property tax would bring, tax dollars from Wolfboro, Tuftonboro, Moultonboro, Jackson, Bartlett, Freedom, Eaton, Waterville Valley, the towns I represent, Sandwich, bring tax dollars from those communities to help in Manchester. There are more, members of the legislature from Manchester than there are from, Wolfboro and Tuftonboro, et cetera. So that's one of those things where it is a scary proposition that, the people that would benefit would outvote the people that would pay. That's why the statewide property tax in the past, when it was tried before, was extraordinarily divisive. And, you know, thankfully we were able to, you know, change it 10 years ago so that, you know, if you would have been in the category of being a donor town, like, for instance, Wolfboro, Tuftonboro is, because your property tax base allows you to raise more revenue than what the state needs for the adequacy amount. And that excess revenue under the old statewide property tax would be then redistributed to Manchester, Nashua, et cetera. Now, under the formula that I had a, you know, lot to do with 10 years ago, that revenue stays in that community. So while on paper, you're raising more revenue than you need to for the statewide property tax, it stays in your community. So you're not making a donation. So there are 234 communities in New Hampshire. Right now, the number of donor towns under a fairly low statewide property tax is about 40. Under the proposal that the Education Funding Commission came up with, it climbs to about 80. So, you know, two out of three communities would get money, one out of three communities would have to donate money to other communities. That is a recipe, in my opinion, for disaster. Divisiveness, recriminations. We've been there, we've done it, and like Yogi said, it would be deja vu all over again, and we don't need to do it again. But if two out of three communities are going to benefit from it, there's, you know, it's likely to keep rearing its ugly head. Now, you know, myself and others have been pretty successful in being able to, you know, keep it at bay, but, you know, we'll see what happens in the future. But it's one of those things that, you know, there would be a lot of support for it, but some people, you know, myself included, would think it's a really bad idea.
On that subject of divisiveness and things, I want to speak a little bit about the new rule about what they call critical race theory, systemic racism, teaching in the schools. Can you kind of dumb that down for some of us? Because I'm not sure I get what this bill actually means.
Well, the people that are opposed to this bill are trying to label it as censorship and a prohibition on, you know, teaching or doing anti-bias training for employment, you know, about racial issues. And it's not that at all. In fact, the legislation has very clear provisions that make sure that whether it's teaching in schools or employment training, that you can talk about, you know, racial issues, both historical and present day, and you can talk about, you know, biases and things like that. And those are discussions that we should have, okay? But where it crosses the line and where it becomes discrimination, especially in a school setting, is when the characteristics that a youngster is born with, their race, their sex, and other characteristics like their sexual orientation maybe, or their gender identity, or their religion, or, you know, things like that, that somehow they get taught by virtue of the characteristics that they can't change, that they are inferior, that they are superior, or that they are somehow oppressing others. And that is discrimination. When you're telling a youngster that he or she, by virtue of, you know, their age, their sex, their race, something is wrong with them, that becomes a very real problem. And that's what this bill will prevent. And so, you know, legitimate discussions about, you know, some of the racial problems that this country has had, no problem. we should be having those discussions. This bill will stop that. It, in my opinion, it encourages it, but it also, you know, makes it really clear, Eric, that you can't cross a line and start telling people by virtue of the way they were born that, you know, they're inferior, superior, or oppressive. And so I think that there's been a lot of discussion about it. I think that people are trying to categorize it, those folks who are opposing it, as something that it isn't. And, you know, I would urge people to read it carefully. I think if you, it's kind of complicated, but if you go to the state website, you go to the, you know, find a bill section and go to put in HB2, House Bill 2, in the icon button. It's right on the homepage of the legislative website. And then I believe it's around page 148 to 150, and it's section 297, I believe. So you can find it fairly easily. It's a 250-page bill, but that's where it is. It's three pages. It'll take 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes to read. People should read it, because I think when people read it, they'll say, wait a minute. I don't want my kid being told that, you know, by virtue of, you know, the characteristics he or she was born with, that there's something the matter with them. I don't want that in my school, or I don't want, you know, if I'm applying for a job in the public sector, this doesn't apply to private sector employers, that, you know, somehow because of characteristics I'm born with, that I'm, you know, I'm an oppressor, or I'm superior or inferior. I think it's pretty clear.
Well, I think so, but in most parts of New Hampshire, you can go literally days or weeks without seeing someone of color. And race is such a touchy subject nowadays. Is this a tempest in a teapot?
No, I don't think it is. And in fact, you know, I've talked at length with a, you know, gentleman from Hanover who, you know, kind of brought this issue to the attention in New Hampshire, what was going on with his kid's education in the Hanover school system. And, you know, I think obviously if we look at what's going on around the country too, and, you know, we want to make sure the kids and people, when they're applying for jobs, are not discriminated against. And so this legislation that was in the budget, you know, in the, whatever, around page 150 in section 297, it will prevent that kind of discrimination. It's not any kind of ban on discussing, you know, topics involving racism or sexism or bigotry or homophobia or any of the kind of discussions that we should be having. But you can't bring it down to the level of a kid who, you know, could be 7 years old or 8 years old or 12 years old or whatever, that suddenly, by virtue of the way they were born, they're an oppressor. I don't think so. I think virtually all people in New Hampshire would say that's just not who we are in the Live Free or Die state. We don't want our kids being taught that.
Why do you think this bill is so controversial?
This is, again, when I was saying before how people become captives of the narrative, I think that this is one of those instances where, you know, people that maybe don't see it in the same way as I do are looking for a political advantage, and they're, you know, seeing that for whatever reason they have some sort of a political advantage for, you know, castigating others as, you know, being racist or bigots or what have you, and they're raising objections to it. But I think when rational people read the bill and they think, well, I want my kids or my grandkids taught, you know, that somehow, you know, when they're that age, that, you know, they are an oppressor? I don't think so.
No, I understand that. I really don't see why this bill is kicking up some of the dust that it has, but I appreciate you explaining it. Thank you very much. It's 1247 here on WASR. Senator, what was your favorite moment as a state senator?
Well, I've had a lot of them because I've been very fortunate to have been on the yes side of things many times, but I guess, you know, passing this budget is certainly a real good highlight because I think, you know, we try to solve a lot of different problems. We've dedicated more resources to mental health and to substance abuse and to families that have disabled children. And we set the stage for continuing, you know, economic growth and opportunities for people to have jobs. Those are always the things that are, you know, the most important to me. So I think I'd say that's one of the highlights that, you know, I'm proud to have worked on. I think Medicaid expansion, going back a few years ago, you know, is a bill that took a lot of work to get passed the first time and the second time and the third time. And, you know, now we'll, at some point in the next couple of years, have to reauthorize it again. But I think it, you know, it has become institutionalized that, you know, it's a good idea. It helps taxpayers, actually, and provides health insurance for people of modest means, and helps get people back into the workforce. So I always feel pretty good about being able to solve problems that help people have opportunity. Because I think that, you know, we're a state that believes in hard work and personal responsibility, and, you know, so I think that providing opportunity for people, that, you know, has always been something that I care about a lot. And those are, you know, when you can, when the economy's doing well and people's paychecks are growing and the unemployment rate is low and our poverty rate is the lowest in the country, and, you know, the U.S. News and World Report's Most Livable State survey has us ranked as number 4. Those are good things. And it, you know, it's not any one individual's work. It's what we do as a team, you know, in the House, in the Senate, with the governor's support. Hopefully legislation, I always think it's better when it's bipartisan, but it's not always, doesn't always work out that way. But, you know, trying to do my part as a member of the team is important to me.
Do you have a least favorite moment?
I haven't had too many of those. I will say that you asked me about the bill that, you know, the bail reform bill. I was pretty upset that did go forward this year. So I think in recent memory, that's probably my least favorite moment.
Okay. If somebody came down and tapped you on the shoulder and said, you know what, you can snap your fingers and repeal any law on the books in New Hampshire, do you know which one it would be?
Whoa, now you're really asking me the lightning round. I'm going to have to think about that one. There probably would be, you know, I probably ought to be able to give you something at the tip of my tongue, but
that's okay. Well, what would you create if you could snap your fingers?
So, you know, next year I'm hoping we bring back the Medicaid dental benefit. That kind of got caught at the end of the Senate passed it. The House was, I think they wanted more time to look at it and the cost implications of it. I happen to think that, like Medicaid expansion, it's going to be you know, very helpful to people, to adults, that children are covered right now if they're Medicaid eligible, but adults aren't, except for emergencies. Good dental health helps overall. So physical health, and it helps people get back into the workforce. So I think that, you know, that's something I'm looking forward to next year. And, you know, I've been a sponsor of the legislation with Senator Rosenwald, a Democratic colleague of mine, for a couple of sessions now. So I think that's important. Affordable housing is another big issue, you know, for me. And we were able to dedicate a lot of new resources because we're generating so much revenue into the Affordable Housing Fund. And I think that that's been really helpful, because that is a problem in New Hampshire, having, you know, enough access to housing. I'll continue to do everything in my power to put more resources into mental health and upgrading our mental health systems. We're doing that. I think right now we've actually dedicated the resources. Now it's just a question of getting the system stood up. So that's something, you know, I'm going to look pretty carefully at over the next year, certainly as, you know, we come back into session too.
Speaking of looking into the next year, is it too early to start thinking about political opponents?
You know, I mean, I don't really get too caught up in that until generally in May or June of, you know, the year that you're going to run, and we'll just see what happens. And I've been very blessed to, you know, I have won 7 terms in the Senate, and, you know, I have to decide, am I still doing a good job, or do I want to do the job, you know, and I'll make that decision over the next few months, and we go from there.
Okay. It's 12:54 here on WASR. We're talking with Jeff Bradley, New Hampshire State Senator. Would you support municipal or state-owned electric vehicle charging stations?
Yeah, I don't know why not.
Well, I just, you know, a lot of people think that it should, they should be private, and I didn't know if that, you know, if, like, say, Wolfboro wanted to get into the electric charger business.
I wouldn't have a problem with it. I mean, I think a lot of communities are, you know, thinking about it, if not actually developing charging stations. And I think a reason for a municipality to do it is that, you know, they are in control of parking. You obviously have to be able to, you know, park a vehicle to be able to charge it. So it makes sense for municipalities to, you know, be in that business. Obviously, you got to figure out how to pay for it, and it shouldn't be free. But, you know, those are resolvable problems.
Okay.
And it will be an issue that, you know, we all have to deal with, because I think increasingly vehicles are going to be electric, and that's a good thing. Technology is moving fairly rapidly in that regard, and as battery technology gets better, not only is it going to be good for vehicles, but going to be good for our overall electric grid as we move, you know, to more, you know, renewable solar, wind, hydro, you know, type of clean energy sources. But right now, you know, they're largely intermittent, which means, you know, they have a 35% to 40% capacity. Day like today, I'm looking out my window, the sun ain't shining, wind is not blowing enough to turn a windmill. So what does that mean? Well, it means you got to have natural gas or nuclear power or, you know, coal or whatever. But with battery technology that is economical, that's a game changer, and that's coming.
Should there be a state incentive to buy electric vehicles, like there is a federal tax credit right now?
You know, I think the federal tax credit is probably ample at this point in time. You know, that may be something that a state like New Hampshire wants to consider, but we don't have an income tax. And in my view, we should not have an income tax. So, not exactly sure where you take the tax credit against if you were going to have it for individuals to purchase.
Well, it could be a monetary incentive. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the tax code, but still. I mean, what is it, $7,500 on the federal tax credit?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Switching gears in our last couple of minutes, have you seen, obviously you have seen the unemployment rates in the country. We have one of the lowest rates. Is it sustainable? Can we continue to operate with an unemployment rate this low?
Well, I think there are two things when you look at the unemployment rate. I mean, first, our rate is one of the lowest, if not the lowest in the country, which is really good news. I think through the pandemic and really since the last recession in 2008-09 timeframe, people left the workforce for whatever reason. So as wages are going up, that attracts more people back into the workforce. And if we're going to sustain economic growth, you know, we need that to happen. And I think, you know, another issue that I identified, New Hampshire needs to attract more younger workers to come to the state. So housing is a big part of that component. That's one reason why, you know, I've been so supportive of measures to increase affordable housing supply.
Well, we touched on it very briefly a little while ago. Do you plan on reintroducing your broadband bill in the next session, or is that the one that's held over for study?
No, it passed.
Oh, it passed.
I think the governor is going to sign it on Tuesday, and then we actually, the bill was going to be implemented and run through the Office of Strategic Initiatives, which has gotten folded into the Energy Department. And at the last minute, the governor asked me to move that, you know, the Broadband Matching Grant Initiative to the Bureau of Economic Affairs. And so we did that in the budget.
Okay. When the governor signs a bill, does he do the same thing the president does, use different pens and gives them to different people?
He does.
He does.
He uses about 4 or 5 pens.
Oh, okay. And do you have some of those pens?
I do.
Oh, okay. All right. Unfortunately,
I will often give the pen away to somebody else. I mean, he signed the Payroll Protection Plan bill and gave me a pen, and I can't remember who I gave it to, but it may have been Senator Hennessy, because she had a lot to do with it. So, anyway. Okay.
Unfortunately, Senator, we are out of time. Thank you once again for taking the time. I know you're a busy guy, and we appreciate it. And hopefully you'll find something to do indoors, because it looks like today's going to be a washout.
It sure does. All right, Eric. Take care. Talk to you next week.
All right. You take care, Senator. Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Bye now. It is 1 o'clock. News is next on WASR.